This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, the 1st of February, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. Two Democratic defectors are making it more difficult to garner the 60 votes necessary to pass a resolution opposing Bush's troop increase. Federal judges hear oral arguments in the case of the only so-called enemy combatant detained in the United States.
It would allow essentially the king to lock someone in the tower without any judicial review. And it would really take us back, undo more than four centuries of Anglo-American legal tradition.
And remembering political columnist Molly Ivins.
I'm here on my usual mission in life, which is to cheer up persons of the progressive persuasion.
All that and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Iraq has witnessed another day of intense violence with a double bombing at a market in Hilla and three separate attacks in residential areas of Baghdad. Hiba Dawood reports.
Iraqi Vice President Tariq al-Hashim is calling for the immediate implementation of a new security plan in order to cure the sectarian violence that has been spiraling out of control. 100 kilometers south of Baghdad, two suicide bombers blew themselves up today in a vegetable market in town of Hilla, leaving 45 dead and 150 wounded. Shiite businessman Muhammad Hassan is a resident of Hilla.
Frankly, the war is open between the Sunnis and the Shiites. And we know that in wars, everything is allowed. Any war is unethical. And since the sectarian strife is at its peak now, the Sunnis won't hesitate to do anything to the Shiites, and the Shiites won't hesitate to do anything to the Sunnis.
In addition to the bombing in Hilla, at least 10 people were killed in three separate attacks in Baghdad today. Mortars landed in a Sunni neighborhood just hours after two separate attacks in predominantly Shiite areas of the capital. For FSRN, I'm Hiba Dawood reporting.
Lawmakers will now be able to examine documents from the Bush administration's warrantless surveillance program. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
After a year's worth of tense hearings in Congress and lawsuits in the courts, the Justice Department has finally released classified documents and secret court orders that have directed the National Security Agency's five-year-old surveillance program. This comes 2 weeks after the Bush administration agreed to comply with the mandate of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which originally had judicial oversight of sensitive surveillance operations. The members of the Intelligence and Judiciary Committees are now reviewing the material and will decide if further oversight is needed. The Bush administration has said it will not make the classified information publicly available. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
After a news blackout lasting nearly a week, it's emerged today that Tony Blair was questioned by police for a second time over allegations that political appointments, seats in the House of Lords, were granted to large donors to Tony Blair's Labour Party. From London, Naomi Fowler has more.
Police questioned the Prime Minister last Friday, but kept the news from the press until today. They've since re-arrested Tony Blair's chief party fundraiser, Lord Levy, on suspicion of conspiracy to pervert the course of justice. There's been speculation that the police investigations may have uncovered a parallel email system operating in the Prime Minister's office in Downing Street. Also that police have been frustrated by lack of cooperation and access to official communications and documents. Member of Parliament Angus McNeill of the Scottish Nationalist Party was the one who first made the formal complaint to the police.
I hope we don't have Downing Street again, as they were a few months ago, spinning against the investigation. But Downing Street understand that this isn't a political move, this is a criminal justice move, and it deserves respect and time. And I hope Downing Street are not trying in any way to undermine the investigation.
The British public is now watching to see whether there'll be criminal charges. If there are, it will have very serious implications for Tony Blair. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
The Somali Transitional Parliament has elected Sheikh Aden Mohamed Noor as the new parliament speaker after former speaker Sharif Hassan was ousted in mid-January following the fallout from the defeat of the Islamist in December. Abdurrahman Warsame reports from Mogadishu.
The former speaker was opposed to Ethiopian involvement in toppling the Islamists in Somalia. Many in the international community saw the ousting of Sharif Hassan as detrimental to Somali national reconciliation. Meanwhile, a video message posted on the defeated Islamist website warns African countries against sending troops to Somalia. Hooded men with AK-47 and machine guns said any African peacekeepers would be seen as invaders and targeted for attack. The threat was delivered as leaders met at the African Union summit on Somalia in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa. Few countries were willing to commit troops, and only 3,000 to 4,000 out of the 8,500 strong peacekeeping forces needed will be deployed. The AU expects to begin deployment within the next 3 weeks. For FSRN, this is Abdurrahman Warsame in Mogadishu.
Tens of thousands of demonstrators filled Mexico City's Central Plaza yesterday to protest the rapid rise of food prices, particularly in the case of tortillas. The price of tortillas, the basis of the Mexican diet, has been skyrocketing since the first of the year. Prices have as much as quadrupled in some areas. The new administration of President Felipe Calderón blames corn suppliers and tortilla makers for the sudden spike in the price of the staple product. Demonstrators at yesterday's march say the government has the power to fix price controls, but lacks the political will. And those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The Senate heard testimony for two appointees today, General George Casey to become Army Chief of Staff and Michael McConnell to head the intelligence agencies. Meanwhile, a debate on how to proceed in Iraq has heated up in the Senate. Two key Democratic defectors are making a compromise resolution opposing the troop increase in Iraq more difficult to garner the 60 votes necessary to pass it to the Senate. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell reports.
The compromise resolution was pulled together last night. Two military stalwarts made the compact, one from each party, Democratic Senator Carl Levin of Michigan and Republican Senator John Warner of Virginia.
I believe that the changes we made will help us gather broader bipartisan support for the resolution, which has been our goal all along.
That was Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine. She's one of the co-sponsors. Democratic leadership say its components are significant enough for them to support it, and it will be the base bill debated when it comes to the floor next week. The legislation states its opposition to the president's troop increase. It sets a series of benchmarks that the Iraqi government must meet to maintain American support. It says the military leaders must better define the role of Iraqi and American forces, and it prohibits the cutting of funds for troops on the ground. Senator Levin says the funding provision is appropriate.
I think the funding thing is the troops in the field. I don't think people, even if they want to use funding at some future time, believe we should cut funding for troops in the field. I mean, that's what it says in here, troops in the field, and I just don't think we should, and I don't think many senators will vote to cut funding for troops in the field. They may try to use the funding mechanism for to stop additional troops. I think that would be a mistake because you can use a cap on troops to reach the same conclusion without cutting funding for troops at all.
But the language, including the funding restrictions, have turned away two key Democrats. In a written statement, Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin says the legislation is too weak. Yesterday, he introduced a bill that calls for the redeployment of U.S. troops within 6 months, then funding will be cut. Senator Christopher Dodd of Connecticut said he can't support it either. He says the bill supports a status quo and doesn't endorse any change in policy. He has his own legislation that supports a cap on the number of troops. Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, opposes any sort of resolution that opposes the president.
It's all about withdrawal or not withdrawal, okay? I mean, that's what it's all about. You can put lipstick on a pig, but it's still a pig.
Democratic leadership defended the bill. They say it's only a first step, and possibilities to end the war lie in the supplemental funding process or in resolutions that could cap the number of troops. But with the two defectors from the Democratic Party, plus Senator Joe Lieberman of Connecticut, who supports the president's troop surge, and with Senator Tim Johnson of North Dakota in the hospital, it will be difficult to garner the 60 votes necessary to pass the resolution. Both Democratic and Republican supporters say they're working behind the scenes to persuade their colleagues. Meanwhile, the Senate Armed Services Committee heard testimony from General George Casey. He is testifying to be Army Chief of Staff, but much of his testimony focused on Iraq, where he served as the top military officer there. He defended the policies in Iraq, including the recent troop increase.
So I believe that this five brigade plan gives great flexibility to General Petraeus at a very important time in the mission.
The Senate is likely to begin debating Iraq next week. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Federal judges heard oral arguments today in the case of the only so-called enemy combatant detained in the United States. Legal experts say the case is pivotal in determining who can be declared an enemy combatant and whether habeas corpus rights will be restored for non-citizens living in the U.S. FSRN's Catherine Kump was at the hearing today. She files this report.
Ali Saleh Kala El-Mari lawfully entered the United States on September 10, 2001, and lived with his family in Peoria, Illinois, until December of that year, when federal agents arrested him as a material witness in the September 11th terrorist attacks. El-Mari pleaded not guilty to several counts of alleged false statements and financial fraud. But on the eve of a pretrial hearing in June 2003, President Bush signed an executive order declaring El-Mari an enemy combatant. The Brennan Center's Jonathan Hafitz is counsel for El-Mari. Outside the Fourth Circuit Court in Richmond, Hafitz said the implications of this case could be terrifying.
The government said they could do what they have done to El-Mari, to an American citizen arrested in the United States, lock them in a military brig without a lawyer, for months on end, without in solitary confinement, and hold them for life without charge. And that's not something that the Constitution and laws allow.
El-Mari has been held without charge at a Navy brig near Charleston, South Carolina. His case goes straight to the heart of the fight to restore the habeas corpus rights that Congress stripped from detainees in the Military Commissions Act of 2006. Habeas corpus is a long-standing constitutional right that allows a prisoner to challenge the legality of their detention in the U.S. court system. A number of constitutional law experts have filed friend-of-the-court briefs in this case, including Dean of Duquesne Law School Don Guter.
Unless the courts are closed or we're in a time of national emergency, which hasn't been declared, then I think anyone should have the right to avail themselves to habeas.
Guter is also a retired Rear Admiral who served 30 years in the Navy.
We seem to be making rules as we go along. Any of the exceptions we make to the normal course of how we have been doing business, whether it's court opinions, whether it's new legislation, whether it's not, in some of our minds, not complying fully with the spirit and intent of Geneva Conventions, all of those things we think put our own troops at risk, because when they're captured, what keeps the capturing country from making up their own rules?
Arguing for the U.S. government, Assistant Solicitor General David Selmans urged the court to consider cases like this individually and not to define the outer bounds of enemy combatant determinations. But Attorney Hafitz called this a blank check for the president to declare anyone on U.S. soil an enemy combatant.
If we're to strip this court of its two centuries old habeas corpus jurisdiction, we would be an unconstitutional suspension of the writ. It would allow essentially the king to lock someone in the tower without any judicial review. And it would really take us back, undo more than four centuries of Anglo-American legal tradition.
Attorneys believe this case could go to the U.S. Supreme Court. In Richmond, I'm Catherine Kamp for Free Speech Radio News.
The UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change's report will be released tomorrow in Paris. The report, which is issued once every 5 years, is used to guide policymakers to develop strategies to combat global warming. A draft of the report indicates that worldwide we'll see increasing temperatures, rising sea levels, and more intense hurricanes and tropical storms. Michael Zemp works with the World Glacier Monitoring Service. The group, in operation since the 1800s, receives glacier data from 30 correspondents around the world.
And what we see is that since the 1980s, the data from reference glaciers in nine mountain ranges show a trend in glacier thinning, which is accelerating. So, for example, since 2000, these reference glaciers did show about 60 centimeters of overall thickness loss.
While scientists that monitor global warming worry that public awareness regarding the issue of climate change needs to increase, transnational corporations appear to ignore global warming and are currently pushing to extend industrialized agriculture models and to use genetically modified crops on the African continent, although such agriculture is more vulnerable to climate change. Richard Worthington works with the South African Climate Action Network.
It is the mission of transnational corporations to accumulate capital. So whatever they think about climate change, their bottom line is always just economic. The social and ecological dimensions always come second, even if they are quantified. In too many cases, they're not even quantified. These days, you hear a lot about corporate social responsibility, and in corporate annual reports, you get a component that there'll be some window dressing, you know, some nice projects happening in communities where corporations are doing some good work. But it's a tiny fraction compared to their overall impact.
Worthington notes that the African continent is already feeling the effects of global warming as farmers begin to try to adjust to changing temperatures and water scarcity.
One of the things that you can already see is the rapidly reducing ice pack on the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, as well as on the top of Mount Kenya. Now, the people living in the surrounding foothills all depend on that the water storage that happens in the ice pack. So once the ice pack disappears, you will only get water provided by rainfall. You won't get that store that feeds the rivers all year round. When we were in Nairobi last year for the climate change negotiations, there was a taxi driver who actually said to me, "Oh, you're here about the climate change negotiations." "Yeah, I know, we know about climate change because the people where I come from, the people who keep cattle are fighting with the people who are growing crops because there's not enough water for both."
The report on climate change will be released tomorrow. We'll have coverage of the release from Paris. The White House is asking Congress to renew trade promotion authority known as Fast Track, which allows the president to negotiate trade deals that are sent to Congress for a simple up or down vote. Democrats are calling for more congressional oversight of trade agreements, and it's unlikely they would renew Fast Track without new conditions. Nan McCurdy has more from Capitol Hill.
Democratic Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota did not support fast-track negotiating authority for President Clinton. He won't do it for Bush either. He says the Constitution says that Congress should be involved in trade issues.
What happens these days is trade negotiations are done in secret. They bring back an agreement under fast track, and there's no opportunity to change it. We have an $800+ billion a year trade deficit. Our trade policies have been abysmal failures, shipping American jobs overseas, and they've all been enacted under fast track, which ties the hands of Congress from offering any amendments of any kind. And I just oppose fast track.
In 1993, the Republican-controlled Congress denied fast track negotiating authority to President Bill Clinton. They never returned that power to him. Clayton Yeider is a former secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and also former trade representative under George Bush Sr. He does not think the Democratic Congress will renew Fast Track for President Bush.
I think that it's unlikely to be renewed except perhaps for very specific purposes and for a relatively short time span if that becomes desirable.
Martin Shupak of Church World Service is co-chair of the Interfaith Group on Trade and Investment. His religious coalition thinks Fast Track has been abused to get trade agreements passed quickly. He says they are harmful to people in developing countries.
Our concern with trade promotion authority is that Congress needs to play a stronger role, not cede their authority to the president, but to make sure that trade agreements are fair and just, both to people in the United States and in developing countries.
Many Colombian and U.S. organizations say the agreement being negotiated by President Bush with Colombia is a good example of one that should not be passed under fast track. Instead, they say Congress should open up the text and rewrite the whole agreement to ensure environmental, labor, and human rights protections. Enrique Daza is the coordinator of the Colombian Network Against the Latin American Free Trade Agreement. As long as fast track is alive, he thinks Congress should vote no to the agreement with Colombia. He says that Congress really needs the authority to totally renegotiate this agreement because of growing illegitimacy of the Uribe government in Colombia.
A bad free trade agreement has been negotiated by a corrupt government connected to paramilitary forces behind the backs of our population. That is going to ruin the countryside and the population.
Democrat Sander Levin, House Ways and Means Trade Subcommittee Chairman, said last week that the only way to address Democratic complaints about the labor provisions in the U.S. free trade agreements with Colombia, Panama, and Peru is to renegotiate the labor chapters of these free trade agreements. And that would only be possible if Fast Track is not renewed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurdy.
Greece was shaken by the loud and combative slogans of students today, opposing a plan to create private colleges and universities in the country. Addis Economou reports.
Today, Greece was shaken once more by the loud and combative slogans of students. It all started 3 weeks ago, when Greece's right-wing government, backed by the opposition Socialist Party, announced plans to revise Article 16 of the Greek Constitution. Article 16 ensures public and free education for all Greek citizens. It explicitly forbids the creation of privately owned and funded universities and colleges. The proposed revision would permit the creation of private universities, though this could not be run on a for-profit basis. It also opens the way for the recognition of the already existing ones that have, up until now, been circumventing Article 16 by functioning as franchises of foreign universities. Kostas Kourakis was among 6,000 demonstrators in Thessaloniki. Why are you demonstrating today?
Well, practically we're demonstrating against the education reform that's taking place in Greece. It's also a constitution reform that we're against, and it's new education laws that follow the capitalist directives of the European Union.
Since the revision was announced, more than 300 campus occupations have taken place. University lecturers and research staff have held 2 2-day strikes, and 2 demonstrations involving 30 to 40,000 students have taken place. Across the country, on Wednesday, we witnessed one of the biggest and most combative demonstrations in years. More than 20,000 marched in the capital, Athens. Here in Thessaloniki, there were 1,000 students in the streets. According to some student representatives, the situation is explosive. The current protest follows similar resistance to education reforms last year. Universities were occupied for 2 months in May and June. At that point, the government wanted to abandon the principle of academic asylum, which protects political and social liberties on campus and prevents police from entering. It also proposed the downward revision of university budget, the introduction of managers to rationalize spending and organization, as well as the introduction of charges for textbooks, which are now free of charge. This proposal have been postponed until March of this year. In October, elementary school teachers staged a 7-week strike and secondary school students occupied their schools. This was in answer to repeated attacks on the quality of education, including the introduction of new reference handbooks that, according to teachers, are unscientific, to low teacher salaries and a steady decrease in public spending in favor of encouraging collaboration with private sector. Education Minister Marietta Giannakou defends her government policies.
We are forced by the European Union to apply these reforms. It is for the good of the country and for the best of public education.
Graffiti dubbed on the wall of the Education Ministry retorts to that. Privatizing for the good of the public service is like having sex for virginity. Hectoras Papagiorgiou.
Governing in Greece and Ministry of Education will be against us. They want to service the benefits of European Union and NATO. That order, the workers must be not well educated and should be paid less money than now. This is a rule that European Union has decided since 1999, and now we must gain our rights. We have decided through our schools to be here in the roads and demonstrate for our rights.
The government insists that only a minority of students is in the streets and the general assemblies that have sprung up to coordinate the action, a minority that the government does not want to take into consideration. The pressure is mounting, however, no one is ready to back down. Yet. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aris Economou in Thessaloniki.
Progressive journalism lost one of its most distinctive voices last night. Molly Ivins, a syndicated political columnist, former editor of the Texas Observer, author and teacher known for her dead-on political analysis and an accessible storytelling style, died yesterday after a long battle with breast cancer. In this excerpt of a speech delivered in October 2003, Ivins encourages progressives to lighten up and in the process reveals her own inclination toward humor.
I'm here on my usual mission in life, which is to cheer up persons of the progressive persuasion. And you know as well as I do that it is not easy to be a liberal in Texas. Now, as you know, the only way to survive being a liberal in the great state is to have fun. And I am just as serious as a stroke about this. My friends, as we are out there trying to save the world, make the world a better place, and remind people it's not entirely necessary to screw your fellow citizens every day in every way you possibly can. It is necessary to concentrate on having a good time. If you do not have fun while you are fighting for freedom, first place, it might be the only fun you'll ever get to have because we don't always win. Numero two, you got to have fun because if you don't, you will get tired, cynical, disgusted, burned out, and become absolutely useless. Consequently, think fun.
At the same gathering, Ivins, also involved in producing progressive media, offered this take on liberal and right-wing radio.
One reason liberal radio doesn't work is because if you wind up sandwiched between, you know, 3 hours of Rush Limbaugh and 3 hours of Sean Hannity, that's not your audience. And there's another factor. Liberals, they're wusses, come on. You attack a liberal and the first thing he's going to say is, you know, you may have a point there. What right-wing radio is a certain niche entertainment that appeals to angry white males and it gives them a chance to vent their anger, and Rush is standing up there naming, you know, and the people who are really running the world and ruining your lives are college English professors. And so everybody gets to be mad at college English professors. And what there is in the media now is an artificially created echo chamber for the right end of the political spectrum. And I am not talking about a vast right-wing conspiracy. I'm talking about something that's been lying around out there in plain sight for many, many years. At least 30 years ago, a bunch of guys, including Joe Coors, Richard Millenscape, and a whole bunch of big right-wing money guys, got together and said, you know, we need more of a bigger voice in the media. We need a bigger voice in the national debate. They put together the money for the Heritage Foundation. There are now literally hundreds of right-wing think tanks all over this country full of paid, bought-out scholars who produce extremely bad economic and social theory, which in turn is published in subsidized academic journals, and then picked up by subsidized voices in the media, the Washington Times, the Weekly Standard, that kind of thing, and it thus enters the public debate as though this were something perfectly reasonable to debate about. There's no such thing as global warming. the bell curve and all these other things. And there is no liberal equivalent of it.
Thanks to Pokey Anderson for that archival sound. Political journalist Molly Ivins died yesterday in Austin, Texas. She was 62. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. For Puck Lowe, Antonio Ortiz, Eric Klein, Leanne Caldwell, Shannon Young, Monica Lopez, and Taina Gysi, this is Aura Bogado.